Right now, I'm joined on the phone by James Paul. He is executive director of the Global Policy Forum, which monitors policymaking at the UN and follows very closely the work of the UN Security Council. James Paul worked in the past for many years with MEREP, the Middle East Research and Information Project, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Jim today to talk about Security Council Resolution 1701, as well as the continuing situation in Lebanon, Gaza, and Israel.
Very nice to be with you.
Thank you for joining me today. Let's start off with Resolution 1701. How did that get decided, and why did it take so long to pass, almost 1 month after the conflict started? Give us a rundown of that resolution.
Well, there were calls for a Security Council resolution almost immediately after Israel began its massive bombing strikes, which was in the middle of July. It became clear, however, that the United States would not agree to the Security Council moving towards a resolution because it had made an agreement with Israel that Israel would have sufficient time to carry out its campaign and to supposedly crush Hezbollah, and any Security Council resolution would only come onto the table after the operation had been largely concluded. The United States had already blocked, through a direct veto, an effort by the UN Security Council to address the other front in this war, which is to say the Israeli attacks on Gaza, which had begun more than 2 weeks before that. So this was a case of the United States and Israel acting in concert to prevent UN Security Council action. It was only then, considerably later, that evidently Israel decided that a Security Council action, the time had come for the Security Council to act. Israel, as we know, had quite some serious military setbacks. Their campaign hadn't reached its goals, but and there was tremendous international pressure growing virtually daily on the Security Council to act. The French had felt very, very strongly. One of the five permanent members of the Council felt very, very strongly about the need for action in Lebanon because of their long-standing relations. They were the colonial power, and they continue to have a lot of relations with Lebanon. So for all these reasons, then, negotiations began in earnest in, I would say, around the beginning of August and into the first week of August. And the United States and Israel were interested primarily in a resolution that would bring a very heavily armed UN-mandated force, possibly a NATO force in the form of a multinational force, not a blue-helmeted force, but an independent force, that would come in and more or less fight its way in to southern Lebanon, taking over the battle from the Israeli forces and forcibly disarming Hezbollah. And that was obviously a position that no one else was very interested in supporting. And so there was a lot of changes in the text of the original text of the resolution as it was being floated by the United States. And eventually we got a resolution in which the Lebanese army was to play quite an important role in deploying in southern Lebanon, and the UN force was to be an actual UN peace blue helmeted peacekeeping force, and there were a variety of quite important changes, including at the very end of the resolution. Interestingly enough, there is a reference to resolutions 242 and 338, which were the two resolutions calling on Israel to withdraw from the territories occupied in the War of 1967. So it was a much more interesting resolution. It still was considered a resolution that was unbalanced and too much favorable to one party, that is Israel. But nonetheless, it was a better resolution by far, and that's the resolution that the UN Security Council eventually then adopted. Unanimously, I should say.
And what has been the reaction in Israel to this resolution? I've read some commentary that says it was a victory for Hezbollah. That was only a few people that I read the opinion of. But what's your understanding of the reaction within Israel to this resolution, as well as the ceasefire?
Well, I think the Israeli government was ready to accept this resolution, even though the resolution was way short of what their hopes were when the conflict began. And the outcome was very, very short of what their hopes had been. The Israeli armed forces have largely honored the ceasefire. It's true that in particular, this commando operation in Bekaa, but otherwise, there has been relatively little fighting. And so that shows, in a way, that the resolution meets the interest of both major parties to the conflict, Hezbollah and the Israelis, and therefore it's been something of a success so far, I would say. It was very important that the conflict be stopped, and it has succeeded in that. Within Israel, of course, there's some that find the resolution to be unacceptably negative, but others who wouldn't see it that way. But I think a lot of the critical energy, let's say, within Israel has been directed at the government and at the military. And there's a tremendous amount, there's political turmoil presently in Israel is to understate the matter. The government is teetering. Some say that any day now the government might collapse. It's not clear what would happen after that, but it shows how much public discontent there is for a government that started a war. And when I say that, I mean that there were skirmishes on the border, and we know that, and we know that Hezbollah did capture two Israeli soldiers and kill several, evidently on the Israeli side of the border. But nonetheless, that was not the cause of this war, which I think that's very clear to everyone, and that the Israeli government decided and had been planning to escalate into a major conflict, and so they... I think it's widely understood in Israel that that was a choice that the government made. And this has been criticized because the military performance was very, very bad, and the government generally didn't seem to have a good grasp of what they were doing and where they were going and what kind of resources they had. So it's been an embarrassment, and even some say that it has ended the aura of invincibility of the Israeli Defense Forces. This is the first time ever that they've actually been defeated in conflict. It may be an exaggeration, I don't know, but it's something that's being said, including inside of Israel.
The criticism that I heard was that the resolution did not call for an immediate disarming of Hezbollah, and it didn't have any, plan for how to go about disarming Hezbollah. And the argument was then that was why it was a victory for them, because there was no, kind of punishment or fallout or something like that.
Well, this is, the resolution does refer to the disarming of Hezbollah and the stopping of weapons flows. And it refers to several other Security Council resolutions that deal with the matter. So I don't think that's correct to say that the resolution doesn't deal with it. But if you would argue, if one would argue that the resolution doesn't have a sort of very clear strategy for how to do that, that would be correct. And I think the original Israeli plan, which was this very robust international force, possibly NATO, maybe the U.S. was going to go in there, who knows what ideas they had, and would sort of forcibly disarm Hezbollah. That was off the table. And so now I think there's some very real question as to how disarmed the Hezbollah is going to be. But lots of experts who are very familiar with irregular forces of this kind and the question of disarmament, it's not a easy and straightforward matter. And so you can't just you can capture an army and take their weapons away, but an irregular force melts off into the population and they put their guns in the cellar and then they're maybe ready to fight again. It's very, very difficult to disarm a force like that. And so you have to do two things. You have to come up with a military, with a, so excuse me, with a political solution to the conflict, which is such that those people are not going to feel the need to remain armed. And that brings us to the broader questions of the threat that Israel poses to Lebanon. And we can see very, very clearly that, and the Lebanese in their majority feel that the Hezbollah force is a force defending Lebanon against the threat of Israeli occupation or Israeli attack. And it's a force that is capable of doing that in a way the Lebanese army can't, because the Lebanese army is a regular, normal army that would be completely decimated by Israel if they tried to stand up against any kind of Israeli army attack. So I think we have to understand these things, and we have to realize that in any kind of solid solution to this conflict, there has to be a broad solution to the various different problems that arise around Israel and it, with its occupations of different places like the Golan Heights and the Palestinians. And there has to be a solid settlement of the border issues in Lebanon. And at this point, I think we would begin to move towards a situation where the need for an armed irregular force in southern Lebanon would be reduced, and then we could expect that those people who have their guns in their basement, simply those guns are going to sit there and get rusty, and nothing more is going to happen. I think the idea of seeing Hezbollah as a sort of existential threat to the existence of Israel, or even to the lives and well-being of the people in the northern part of Israel, I think that's basically wrong. I think that this is not a force that's about to somehow attack and take over Israel. That's not at all a reasonable way of understanding what who they are and what they're doing.
And what has the reaction to the Resolution 1701 been in Lebanon, and what has Hezbollah's response been, if you know?
Well, Hezbollah's response has been that they want to see Israel out of the, that they want to see Israeli forces withdrawn from Lebanon, and that they are unwilling to make any guarantees about their behavior until Israel is out of there. And however, what so they've been hedging the statements that I've read from Hezbollah or heard on the radio suggest to me that their main goal is to get Israel out, and that's Israeli forces are beginning to withdraw, as I understand it. The real important thing is that there haven't been any clashes, that they may be some very, very minor firefights, as I understand it, that haven't gone anywhere. So that this, both sides are really committed to honoring this this ceasefire, and that's what I that's why I think we have some very serious hope. Also, and very importantly, is the deployment. I think the within Lebanon, the idea that the Lebanese National Army is deploying into the south as a way towards the solution to this conflict is seen as a very positive thing, and I believe it's seen as a positive thing by Hezbollah themselves. The real hope is that Lebanon and Lebanese destiny will be decided by Lebanese and by the Lebanese government and this kind of thing. So, but that I don't think the Lebanese army is going to be very vigorously involved in disarming Hezbollah, and I don't think the UN force. Now, we should also note that the UN force has gotten some important contributions from France and Italy. These are promises of forces, and that's about 5,000 altogether, and there's, I think, some others from other European countries forthcoming. So there is going to be a fairly serious increase, and already is an increased deployment of the UNIFIL, which is the name of the UN peacekeeping operation that's already been there. It's really what's happening here is not a new peacekeeping operation, but the very huge increase in what was a small observer force that was in southern Lebanon already.
Do you think the ceasefire is going to hold?
Well, I think I really think so, because basically I think, as I said earlier, that I think the parties have an interest in it holding. I think Israel is not in any position to begin military operations again. There's a tremendous scandal about the effectiveness of a lot of reserve officers have been protesting outside the prime minister's office. There's been accusations by many soldiers that they didn't have food, water, and ammunition. I mean, it's just the famous Israeli army that we've read about all these years. I mean, it just seemed that that there was incredible errors, obviously on the side of military intelligence. There were very serious errors as well at the level of the strategic concept, which was this bombing campaign that was supposed to take care of Hezbollah and practically wipe them out before the army came in. That was a total failure. So in many, many regards, the Israelis, as I would see it, are not ready and willing or able to begin another campaign. And on Hezbollah's side, they've certainly taken many casualties. There's been a lot of destruction. They're claiming that they successfully stood up against the Israeli colossus, and therefore they're heroes and so forth. So they're ready to sort of rest on their laurels at this point and not get beat up anymore either. So I think both sides, there's this kind of a relief that this war is over, and certainly the Lebanese people are not keen to see any more fighting. There's been terrible destruction in Lebanon.
I'm speaking with James Paul. He's the executive director of the Global Policy Forum, which monitors policymaking at the UN and follows very closely the work of the UN Security Council. He also worked with MEREP, Middle East Research and Information Project, for many years. Just have a couple more questions for you today, Jim. We only got about 5 minutes left, and I want to know, I want to talk about Gaza in a minute, but before we turn to that, if you could respond to, I've been, right after the ceasefire happened, it seemed like everybody was claiming victory. You had Israel saying, you know, that they prevailed, they, you know, kicked Hezbollah out of southern Lebanon. You had Hezbollah saying they had prevailed, had struck Israel in a way that no, you know, that so many other Arab nations had not been capable of. You had the U.S. and Bush claiming, you know, victory. What is your response to that, to all those proclamations of coming from so many different sides of this.
Well, this is—I mean, war is a terrible thing, and we people who go around making war or getting excited about war are irresponsible fools. And I think that people on either side who think that somehow things are better off now than they were before are not being at all sensible and being quite irresponsible, in fact. This was a terrible destruction. Many, many people were killed. And it's going to take a long time to bring Lebanon back. In fact, Lebanon has suffered from a long civil war in the past. Also, the terrible results of the 1982 Israel attacked in 1978 first, and then 1982. And after 1982, they remained in occupation until the year 2000 in the southern area. In 82, Beirut was very badly destroyed, what was left of it after the Civil War. So this can't be any good for Lebanon as a society and for the Lebanese people. And but I think it's clear that the major responsibility for this war lies with Israel and the United States, who plan to do it, irrespective of the attack by Hezbollah. And it may be a war that was connected up somehow to the idea of an attack on Iran. It's part of the tremendous amount of violence that the United States in particular is employing in the Middle East area. And so, no, this is not, nobody should be excited about this.
And what about the two soldiers? That was the initial justification for the bombardment of Lebanon, was that two soldiers had been captured, taken hostage, whatever. Where are they? Is there any news about their situation? Are they still being held?
Well, I believe I'm pretty sure they're still in the hands, I guess, of Hezbollah. But I think there's every reason to expect that they would be... there'd be some kind of a trade, perhaps of some Lebanese prisoners in Israeli hands.
Which is what the Hezbollah fighters that took those two soldiers in the first place were asking for. So if that ultimately happened, it would kind of be like, why was there all this destruction?
Yes, well, yeah, of course. So anyway, I think that's what's going to happen. Let's get to Gaza before the end of this show.
Of course, I want to ask another question about what we're talking about here, and we will get to Gaza,
okay.
And we'll try to give a few more minutes to it. You mentioned Iran, and it seems like the real motivations for this had so little to do with these two soldiers, because you don't even really hear about those two soldiers anymore. I mean, it became more about, claiming that Lebanon or that Hezbollah was a front for Iran and Syria and that this was a war against, So, can you talk about what this war was really about and how the U.S. and our obsession with Iran kind of play into that?
Well, there's... in Washington, there's an awful lot of extremely ignorant policy people, people who work for think tanks or who work for the National Security Council who, have never been in the Middle East but are given a lot of responsibility for Middle East policy. Or they've been to the Middle East, but they've only been to Israel. And these people work in terms of stereotypes and work in terms of ideas that they've been fed by interested parties. And certainly the whole concept of Iran, and we hear people like Patrick Clawson, who's, an incredibly ignorant fool, who's constantly harping about the threat of Iran to the whole world. And... These these policy types have decided that Hezbollah is nothing but a pawn in the hands of the mullahs in Iran, and that if they're not completely crushed, they may result in the destruction of Israel and the destruction of U.S. interests in the Middle East and all this kind of thing. Hezbollah is, I think, fairly clearly receiving some arms and some money from Iran. And I think they're getting some arms and they're getting some money from Syria. I think they're also getting quite a bit of money from Lebanese who are living outside of Lebanon and so on, so that there's a number of different flows of funds. And I think it's important to see Hezbollah as not simply a puppet of Iran or of Syria, but rather it has grown up in a very indigenous way. It's responded to the crisis in southern Lebanon, the tremendous poverty of people in southern Lebanon, and first and foremost, as a military, as an organization that has an important military side, it grew up in response to Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon, and we cannot ever forget that. From 1982 until 2000, that's 18 years of occupation, and it fought against that occupation as a national resistance. Now, does this make it a pawn of Iran? I don't think so. Think for a minute about George Washington and his forces in the United colonies. They got a lot of support from France. In fact, without the support of France, they might never have won. Did that make them a pawn of France? Has anyone ever said that? No, that would be ridiculous. So I think you have to realize that movements of this type take support where they can, and that may give them some connection to that, the sources of that support, and so on. But it does not mean that they're nothing but a puppet in the hands of that supporter. And Israel is not a puppet in the hands of the United States either, by the way, even though it certainly gets a lot of support from the U.S. So I think that's the way we have to understand this. And Washington pundits are trying to frame this war in completely the wrong way. Now, some say that the war was seen by Israel and by the United States as a couple of things in regard to Iran. First of all, it was seen as taking out Iran's friends first before attacking Iran. And Princess Seymour Hersh refers to that in his recent New Yorker article. The second point is that there were... it was said that the Iranians had helped the Hezbollah develop some bunkers and so forth where they were fighting from in the south, and that if the Israeli military could take out those bunkers, then that would be a trial run for the attacks on Iran itself and Iran's nuclear facilities. If Israel could prevail with an air war, then it would be easy to move to Iran and to weaken and even bring down the Iranian government through an air war alone. All these fantasies were proven false in this war, and therefore, if there's anything positive that has come out of the war, it may be that it has given a certain pause to the people in Washington. Foolish as they are, but they have to, you know, they have to have some connection to reality. And so maybe we're not going to go in for massive attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities, which was something that looks like it was beginning to happen. It's not off the table, but it may be somewhat less probable now than it was before.
Let's spend the last few minutes talking about Gaza. Is there any connection between the situation in Lebanon and the Israeli occupation of Gaza, and just generally, if you could talk about the situation there, because it seemed like it kind of fell off the radar screen when the situation in Lebanon started really heating up.
Well, unfortunately, the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories is never very much on the radar screen of the U.S. media and even of, intellectuals who are concerned with peace and so forth in the United States. It's something that is very, very quickly forgotten and pushed aside. And however, the situation has been simply disgraceful in the Israeli occupied territories. When an election was held and Hamas won that election, the sense was in not only the United States but in Western Europe and Canada, we have to get rid of those people. We can't see them, and they had just been elected as a government. There was an election, and Hamas was moving quite substantially towards modifying its position so that it could act. It was surprised, actually, that it won. It didn't expect to win that election. And instead, aid was cut off, and the Israelis, refused even the most minimum contact with them. And it just created even more poverty and resentment in the Palestinian territories than there had been before. And almost no one in the United States or in the West raised a serious voice against this. And it's against that background then that Israel attacked Gaza after skirmishes on the border. And it's easy for somebody who wants to put forward the theses of Israel to say, "Oh yes, there were these rockets that were coming in." That's absolutely right. And but it's also very important to understand that there were Israeli attacks on Gaza, including air attacks, attacks from ground artillery, and all sorts of things that were killing people there. And so we could say that there was more skirmishes on that border than there were in the Lebanese border. And when the Israeli government decided to make its move, again, it had to do with the capturing of one or two soldiers. It was a tremendous escalation, and they moved in again with tremendous military forces in there. And that's when the war part one began. So, we could go at length into the whole question of the status of Gaza after this so-called Israeli withdrawal. I mean, the Israelis pulled out a few very small settlements. They did withdraw, but Gaza was kept as a prison. It was the Israel controlled its borders completely. They were shutting off. They were not allowing exports of products. Agricultural products and so forth. There was control of the sea access. There were all kinds of things. There was control of the border to Egypt and everything. So Israel wasn't. This was not a. It was not a great and progressive gesture on the part of Israel to withdraw from Gaza because it was not part of a negotiated settlement and only a negotiated settlement between the two parties is going to lead to a permanent peace, and that's true when we look at the whole region around Israel, and we look at the Palestinian territories, and we look at the occupied Golan Heights, and we look at Lebanon. It's time for Israel to realize that peace with its neighbors is the best form of security.
Finally, I mean, I'd love to talk more. I can think of a bunch of questions that come out of what you were just saying, but we're pretty much out of time. I've been speaking with Jim Paul, Executive Director of Global Policy Forum. They monitor policymaking at the UN and follow very closely the work of the UN Security Council. He also worked for many years with MERIT, Middle East Research and Information Project. One last question. What would you suggest to my listeners as U.S. citizens or I mean, I can't assume everybody listening is a U.S. citizen, but folks here in the U.S., what do you suggest to them might be a course of action they could take on several levels, maybe? And then how can we learn more about the organization you work with?
Well, to answer the last question first, Global Policy Forum has a very large website at www.globalpolicy.org, and that's probably the largest website or one of the largest in the world dealing with international policy issues. So we have somewhere around 1 to 1.5 million hits on that site every week, so listeners should come and take a look. We have some material on this, the matter of Israel, Lebanon, Palestinians, and the UN Security Council in particular. As far as what people should do as citizens, I mean, I think always the first step is to become very well informed about this, and I think in particular because feelings can run very high when it comes to Israel, that it's very important for people to understand those issues well before jumping into the public arena with them, because if they're not, they're likely to get really, you know, very badly beat up on by those who would like to support what Israel does, you know, and don't hesitate to accuse people of anti-Semitism just because they're critical of something that Israel's policy. So that's the first step, is to be informed, and the Middle East Research and Information Project, which is www.merip.org, I believe, which I worked for many years. It's probably a very, very good place to get some good information. And then, of course, there's all the usual array of things to do. You can protest. You can go out and you can get together with friends and have a group to work on this and contact members of Congress. The Congress is very, very bad in these issues. And finally, I think it's time to have a national boycott of Exxon as a way of saying that we're fed up with the oil companies and the way their interests are dominating U.S. policy and have done for the last 100 years. And we can't boycott all of those companies, but ExxonMobil is the biggest and the nastiest, and why not start with them?
Thanks for joining me today, Jim. Really appreciate
it's my pleasure.
You taking the time. All right. Have a good evening. That was Jim Paul of the Global Policy Forum.